Right, so this is, within the next hour or so, this is a problem that we started working on almost 3 years ago. And there are more questions, that's long, there are more questions than answers. But so I will try to tell you a bit about the progress that we have made through the last few years. This is effectively part of the PhD thesis of my student, Sergei Saprykin. A special thanks go to Evgeny Demekin. He's in the Applied Maths Department of Cuban State University in Russia. This is close to the Black Sea. So let me tell you a little bit what the problem is here. We are interested in the 3D, what I call here generalized Kuramoto-Sivashinsky equation. I will be referring to this as GKS. By 3D here, I mean 2 plus 1 dimensions, that is two spatial dimensions in, if you like, a streamwise and a spanwise direction, and one vertical dimension, the height. And this is what the equation looks like in a coordinate system already transformed with a velocity c, which is constant, yes? So you could view this as a simple nonlinear evolution equation that retains the fundamental elements of nonlinear processes that evolve wave evolution in 3D. We've got the simplest possible nonlinearity in the system, which is quadratic, yes, and it gives you direction because it breaks the reflection symmetry. We've got this term here, which is instability or energy production, a term here, which is stability or energy dissipation, and we've got this dispersive term here, where delta is a parameter that measures the relative importance of dispersion, and its actual value depends on the particular case being considered. There is an interesting discussion of this equation and its applicability, at least in the strongly dispersive case, that is, when delta is large, in a recent, well, not so recent, but a few years ago, paper by Cavahar and co-workers. So there are applications ranging from solitary vortices in plasma all the way to localized rolls in nematic crystals. The problem we are interested in here is the film falling down a vertical plane. Well, it could be inclined plane, but let's talk about the vertical case. And in that, in this problem, there are different versions of this equation, different limits derived by Rosks, Nipomniachtchi, Lin and Krishna. The work by Nipomniachtchi, I should say, is one of the first that derived the Kuramoto-Sivashinsky equation for from a physical system. But the crisp, exact version of this equation was derived a few years ago in a paper by Franco and Interest Kumar. So with a reference to the falling film problem, this term here is the interfacial kinematics due to mean flow, so this is a convective term. This term here has to do with inertia, okay? So it's proportional, if you like, to Reynolds number. This term here has to do with capillarity, so this is surface tension. And this is an odd derivative term. This is interesting. It's an odd derivative term due to the dispersive term due to the viscous part of the pressure. This induces effectively two viscous diffusion terms in the streamwise and the spanwise direction. And in the equation that gives you the flow rate, there is a contribution just with the derivative with respect to x. The simple reason really is because the system has a preferred direction, which is the mean flow direction, the direction of flow. So we can examine, if you like, a little bit the limits of different delta, large or small delta. So in the falling film problem, delta square is found to scale as 1 over the Reynolds number times what we call the Weber number. The Weber number is related to the Reynolds number through something that in the Russian school is quite popular. It's the so-called Kapitsa number, and is fixed for a fixed liquid. Yeah, so it's a function only of the physical properties of the liquid, that is surface tension, viscosity, and of course it will depend on gravity. So we can then look at the limit, for example, of gamma tending to infinity and R fixed. In this case, okay, W will tend to infinity and delta tends to zero. On the other hand, if gamma is large but fixed, we say large because, let's say for water, this is roughly 3,000 at 25 degrees, then if you take the limit of R tending to zero, okay, because this scales as R to the one-third, then delta tends to infinity. And in fact, in the derivation given in that paper, we can obtain this equation by assuming effectively strong surface tension effects. Okay, this is the case of large Weber number. In near critical conditions, that is, the Reynolds number is close to the critical Reynolds number for the onset of the instability on a vertical plane. and this is exactly zero. Alternatively, you can view the limit of zero Reynolds number as a case of very viscous fluid, yes, because this is inversely proportional to the viscosity. Okay, we can also view this equation as an extension to 3D of this 2D prototype here that was analyzed in detail by Kavahar and co-workers. So this is, if you like, in the limit of delta equals zero, gives you a Kuramoto-Sivasinski equation. But Kavahar and co-workers show that in the limit of delta tending to infinity, this equation RS regularizes the spatiotemporal chaos that you see with the Kuramoto-Sivasinski equation. What you obtain instead is a train of spatially periodic cellular structures that look pretty much like the ignoidal wave solution of the Korteweg-Lévry equation. Okay, so the first step here would be, so what we want to know now is what happens in 3D for large values of delta. So the first step here would be to try to obtain at least solitary pulses which are stationary in a moving frame. We have a suspicion that the height h scales with delta, and the same for the velocity c, where lambda is an order one parameter. And if delta is large, we introduce a small parameter here, which tends to zero as delta tends to infinity. We also stretch h and the derivatives with respect to x so that they contain lambda. So there is a lambda here and a square root of lambda here. The advantage of doing that, so there's no time derivative because we are stationary in the moving frame. Yes, the advantage of doing this is that we bring all parameters in the right-hand side of this equation, both epsilon and lambda, and such that as epsilon tends to zero, you lose the right-hand side, and then you have simply a Korteweg-Lévry equation which is free of parameters. So we could then, for small epsilon, try to obtain lambda with a perturbation of a KdV soliton. You note, u hat is the perturbation, so this is the perturbed equation of first order, yes, and f is that operator here. And it's also useful to define an f, an adjoint, with respect to the usual L2 inner product, which is shown here. What is interesting now to observe is that if you operate with u naught, the KdV soliton on f star, you get identically zero. So this is nothing else but a null eigenfunction of the adjoint problem. This then means that if we want to invert this equation here, where f is a singular operator, we just have a solvability condition. That is, we must eliminate any components of this right-hand side in the null space of the adjoint. And that gives us this expression for lambda. And by looking at the derivatives here, you can see this fourth order, this effectively fourth order also, is suggest the introduction of polar coordinates rho and theta. Rho is this the square root of xi square plus eta square. These are the two stress coordinates. The theta is the inverse tangent of this, xi over eta. Okay. And the advantage of doing that is now the theta integration is effectively trivial. So theta can come out of the integral from both sides trivially, and you get a simple expression for lambda in terms of the integrals of u naught, where u naught satisfies this KdV equation now in polar coordinates. This equation here is not integrable, so it has to be solved numerically, but because it's free of parameters, you just need to do one numerical integration. You substitute back here, evaluate the integrals, and obtain that lambda is roughly 0.33. So the velocity c of this pulse is for last delta scales effectively at 0.33 of delta. The first consequence of that is the following. If you just have a pure KdV equation, yes, you have a one-parameter infinite family of solutions, parameterized with a velocity. But as you see here, the presence of the instability and dissipation terms in the GKS equation breaks the degeneracy. Okay? And it breaks it in a way that it selects a particular member of this infinite family of solutions, which one? The one which travels with this velocity. The second important observation, at least from a practical point of view, and for chemical engineers, I don't know if there are any chemical engineers here, but is that this velocity is roughly 3 times smaller than the estimate, which is roughly 7 over 5 delta, for last delta, obtained by Kavahar and co-workers now in 2D. 2D, again, we mean 1 plus 1, yes? And this has some important consequences, if you like, for heat and mass transfer in practical applications. These solitary pulses are used to transfer mass or heat. This is the so-called falling film reactors. And we need large amplitude waves because they have large surface area and hence they enhance heat and mass transfer. There are various complications there, but if the velocity is smaller than the 2D case, it means the corresponding amplitude is smaller and hence maybe the surface area is smaller, which means that somehow one should try to avoid the 3D regime in applications, but that would bring in the issue of the flow control, which is non-trivial. It's something we try to pursue now, but this is another question. That's why I said at the beginning I will be pointing out the various questions here. So the issue of flow control is a big question here. Let's just compare the 0.33 delta estimate with the fully numerical solution. So this is that quantity lambda, yes, normalized with delta, with respect to delta. After delta larger than 50 or so, you approach fairly rapidly the estimate, yes? And the same thing for an appropriately normalized amplitude with respect to delta. Again, after about 50 or 100, we approach the estimate. And it's not surprising, perhaps, that if we do a cross-plot of the maximum amplitude versus the velocity, we get a straight line throughout the domain. Let me show you now a simple experiment that we have done. Now, before I go to the experiment, perhaps it's useful to show you a numerically constructed 3D solitary pulse. This is for a relatively small value of delta, 0.3. So it consists of a large curvature head here with capillary pulses at the front, okay? Capillary waves, maybe I should say, or ripples. It's got two legs at the back. This is more visible than that one. And it's got a pronounced dent. This is a depression. In the case of the falling film problem, that would be due to the capillary pressure, the capillary depression in the legs. All this says is that you cannot sustain a 3D structure on a liquid film without a wake at the back. It appears also that the height of this depression varies very slowly with the streamwise coordinate. We have truncated this here for presentation purposes, but actually that lifts itself up towards the zero level here, which is a fixed point for the system, as you approach towards minus infinity. But this is a slow approach. Let me show you some casts on the z equals zero plane. So what we have now, we look at one of these structures from the top. Yes. And this is our z equals zero plane. And that's a projection there. We have appropriately normalized the height with the maximum height, the shape with the maximum height. So this maximum height is given here in the figure, yes. And notice that as delta increases, what we find, first of all, is that this small amplitude oscillatory structure at the front diminishes, okay, all the way here, but it never really disappears. This is the signature of the dissipation in the system. It is due effectively to capillarity to surface tension for the falling film problem. And it never disappears because although delta tends to infinity, we still have the instability and the dissipation terms in the equation. But what happens is amplitude relative to the maximum amplitude becomes smaller. You also notice that the structure becomes increasingly symmetric, so effectively we approach the KdV limit, but a particular member of the KdV family. And you notice here this depression, as I said before, yes? That lifts itself slowly towards h equals zero as we approach towards minus infinity. Okay, let me show you now, as I was talking before, about a fairly simple experiment that we have done. And this is an experiment that we did it in my house, literally. So what we have here is a very viscous liquid. Delta is 0.09. That's not so important. What we have here is a very viscous liquid falling down. We don't have many, because the Reynolds number is very small, we don't have many disturbance on the surface, but what we have is a needle that actually scrapes the surface of the fluid, okay, and we move it in the downstream direction. And what you notice here is that in front of the needle we have the formation of these capillary ripples, and there is a dent at the back. This is very simple cinematography with a very simple camera. So this configuration, what is interesting is that this configuration of ripples and dent is similar to what we see here. Okay? So then, at the same time, the ripples and dents around the solitary poles are nothing effectively but the linear region around the solitary poles. Okay? So this then suggests that the actual form of the non-linearity is not so important. This is a bit of a drastic statement, but if you really think about it, a solitary pulse exists in an infinite domain, yes? Minus infinity to infinity. So what the non-linearity does effectively occupies just an infinitesimally small, just a point in that infinite domain. Okay? So this is a bit, if you like an impulse response analysis. I have an infinite long solitary pulse. This is my cut, yes, on the z equals zero place. And the non-linearity affects, as we say, a very small region of the pole. So I could then forget about the non-linearity and replace it with a product of two delta functions. That would be equivalent to the, if you like, to an impulse response analysis. For example, in an elasticity theory, yes, or a variety of natural phenomena where what we do, we say, okay, we have a concentrated force in space, a point force, and this is nothing else but a finite impulse, because with the delta function, that will have an infinite amplitude, but a finite area. So let's do that and replace effectively a nonlinear equation with a linear one. Okay, C now becomes the strength of the nonlinearity. This is located at the location at the origin, which is 0, 0. And then the question is, what does this do? First, it converts a nonlinear equation, as I said before, to a linear one. And second, does it tell us something about the region away from the nonlinearity and away from the hump? Yes, it does. Because if you switch off the strength, if you set here C equals 0, effectively what you have is the equation that defines the exponentially decaying tails of a pulse. The fact that C here is different than 0 means that you have the influence of the nonlinearity onto the linear region away from the solitary pulse. Okay, so let's make this assumption and let's see what we can get out of this. We can define a Fourier transform, shown here. Alpha and beta are wave numbers in the two directions, streamwise and spanwise directions. And we can Fourier transform this equation to obtain that. Again, if you set here C equals 0, what you find is that F times the denominator is 0. For a non-trivial F, the denominator must be 0, and this gives you the dispersion relation of a flat film, which is the continuum of Fourier modes e to the minus alpha x e to the minus beta z. For a reason that will become clear later on, I'm going to rescale the wave numbers in that form. So I have new wave numbers, sigma nu. I can now invest this transform and get 1 over 2 pi for its integral here, hence the 4 pi square there, and then I have two integrals on the imaginary axis of this new complex domains, sigma and nu. And this, I've written that explicitly so we can see the structure of this function. These new i's, yes, are the roots of that polynomial, this quartic, which can be solved exactly to give you the poles here. These are simple poles, first order poles, so we can use some elements from complex variable theory to obtain this integral. For example, for delta equals 100, so before I go to that, we replace the integration in the complex new plane with a, as is typically the case with complex variable theory, with a closed counterclockwise contour in the left half of the new complex plane. And for delta equals 100, for example, we have two poles inside this contour. It turns out for all delta, you only have two poles. So then the residual theorem says that the integral in the, on the closed contour gamma is 2 pi I times the sum of the residues, yes? And the residues here of this function are simply those, okay? We evaluate the exponent, a new k, the two poles, and this is this function f, which is obtained as we normally obtain the residue. Okay, so as r tends to infinity, the contribution of the semicircular part here is lost, and we end up with an integration of the imaginary axis, right? So we are effectively, if you like, done with a new integration, rescaling now h so that we absorb the constant, the strength of the nonlinearity into this h tilde. We have this final expression which involves an integration in the complex sigma plane. Again, we can introduce polar coordinates, little r and little theta. Okay, shown here. R equals 0 now in this polar system is effectively the location of the nonlinearity, the location of the delta function. And because we want the influence of the nonlinearity away from the origin, we need the limit of r large, okay? And effectively, we want the asymptotic representation of this integral for large distances. So we have the Laplace's method, yes, for the asymptotic representation of an integral. But for the method to work, okay, which is based, this is effectively the steepest descent method or the method of constant phase, if you like. I mean, it's not quite the same with the method of stationary phase, but the steepest descent contour is effectively a contour of constant phase. And Laplace's method works well, provided that we don't have any saddle points. That is, points where the derivative of this exponent with respect to sigma here vanishes, because their distinct contours can actually intersect. And as it turns out, we have to take the integration contour. When we deform this integral here, we must take it through a saddle point. Otherwise, the integral won't even converge. At least for the case of an infinite contour, like this case here, yes? So let's evaluate the saddle point shown here. And this gives us an analytical expression for the for nu with respect to the saddle point sigma. This plus or minus and that plus or minus here are taken at the same time. This is taken different. Okay, so we have four roots. But we can solve this polynomial if we square it twice. Okay, so we ace the order by four, so we end up with an eighth order polynomial whose coefficients are real. Okay, and that justifies, remember I said before, I had actually converted the wave numbers. So this justifies this different scaling that I did for the wave numbers, so that if we have real coefficients, it's more easy actually to obtain, at least numerically, the solution of that polynomial. But because we raise the order, we have four additional roots, okay, to find which ones are the actual roots. After solving for the eighth roots, we back substitute here and we solve for the four roots that we need. But from these four roots, only two are the saddle points, because we have two nus, if you remember, within the integration contour. And to find which are the two saddle points from these four roots that we eventually obtain, what we do is we take every sigma, substitute here, we find the corresponding nu, and then we check that this nu is actually inside the integration contour. So once we determine the saddle points, we can shift the integration contour, so the path through the saddle points, okay? And two quantities of interest here are the so-called orientation angles, phi 1 and phi 2. These are the angles between the imaginary axis, let's say in the complex sigma plane, with the contour that passes through the saddle point, the tangent to the contour that passes through the saddle point. Because these two angles will enter in the asymptotic, will enter the asymptotic representation. Okay, so this is the deformed integration, the deformed contour, okay? And now that's the Laplace's method. The generic treatment is given in that book, which is actually in Russian. And it's very difficult to find the generic treatment of Laplace's method, okay, in a Western text. In any event, so what we get from that is that the asymptotic behavior to leading quarter is given by something like that. There is 1 over square root of r. There is this quantity gamma here, which contains sigma, nu, and theta, and this orientation angle here, okay? And this AK is effectively a slow amplitude function of theta. It depends on part of the residue, the cosine of the angle, and the second derivative of the pole evaluated at the saddle point. We are not done because we need to determine C if we go back to the original variables. That was the strength of the nonlinearity, and this can only be done numerically, that is by matching the actual solution to the numerical solution to the analytical solution at some point r equals r naught. It turns out that for delta, let's say, larger than 50 or so, any r naught larger than about 5 will give you the same C. And this is the reason we do that, and I will come back to a second. But let me define this linear region a bit more precisely. If I take now one of these solitary poles and I look at it from above, yes? So this is, let's say, the direction of load. This is the Z, is the transverse direction. So that's the direction of flow. So this is, if maybe not so visible, but that's the wake at the back. This red color here means a region of high amplitude, yes? So that's where we have the point force. And there is a bit of a depression around it. In any case, this defines more or less, if you like, the border of this linear region. Most of the domain is linear, and the nonlinearity is just concentrated here. In the particular case, for delta equals 0.3, outside the circle of R, roughly 4, we have very good agreement, yes, with the analytical solution and the numerical one. Let me show you now what the two look like. The green line here is the actual numerical solution, and the dashed line here is the analytical representation, yes, obtained from the method of steepest descents. The first one here is a cut, a plus or minus pi over 4, so we cut here. Okay? And the second one is a cut, plus or minus pi over 2, so this is along the z equals 0 axis. It's not so bad in all cases, except here, it's very difficult to represent this depression, because there is a sensitivity on this low amplitude function in front of the analytical expression. Okay. Let's look at the KdV limit. As I said, we break the degeneracy of the KdV equation, but it's interesting to look at what happens anyway if we just throw away the two terms, this instability and dissipation terms. So we break down the order of equation, yes, from 4 to 3, but this quantity lambda is what we had determined before, so this is roughly 0.33. Again, the same exercise, yes, if we do the Fourier transform, we find two poles, plus or minus the square root of this quantity. We have two saddle points, only one of the two contributes, yes, and this is the final asymptotic representation. Notice here is minus square root of lambda r, the exponent, and it's what you would expect, effectively. These are the steepest curves for the second saddle point that only contributes to the integrals. Now, the steepest descent contour that passes through the saddle point is parallel, yes, to the imaginary axis. What this says is effectively you have a real saddle, therefore the poles are real, and hence you have a perfectly symmetric solution without any oscillations, which is what one would expect, which is effectively shown here just for visualization purposes, yes? So right at the origin you approach a delta function. One interesting point here is that there is an interesting bifurcation diagram for the saddle points. And this will help us to understand how we pass to the KdV limit. This diagram gives you the real part of the saddle point versus the angle theta, and this is the imaginary part versus theta. But there are two branches here for different delta. For example, we have the circles correspond to delta equals 1,000, the crosses to delta equals 10, yes? And if we look, let's say, at delta equals 10, we have this branch. This branch here is always real, okay? So this is not contributing to the oscillations of a solitary pulse. So that is the one which is complex, and its imaginary part is shown down here. So this second diagram shows the imaginary part of the lower branch. But even this branch here, notice that it's only real, I should say, not notice, but I should say it's only real, it's only complex between minus pi over 2 and this value theta star here. That's where we have a complex second saddle point, which is responsible for the oscillations. Above this value of theta star, we have a real root coexisting with another real root with a dashed line here, which is not a true saddle point. That's why we have put it here with a dashed line. But the two roots coalesce at this theta star, and then you get a complex conjugate pair, and after this, we only track the complex root. And its imaginary part shown here. Okay, so it's real up to this point, and then you have an imaginary part. As delta tends to infinity, theta star is pushed down to this value here. It goes down to zero. So everything is effectively real. The imaginary part is zero. And then you get a single solid line shown here, which is in the limit of delta tends to infinity. And the passage to the KdV limit for this single line happens as follows. This line here is made from the segment of that branch that you see here, and the segment of this, of the lower branch that you see here. Okay? So that one and this part here make up the limit of delta tends to infinity. But of course in that limit, if we look at the GK equation, I should have two saddle points. So what happened to the other one is not shown here, but it has exactly sigma r and sigma I zero, and is made up of this segment and of that segment. Okay? So we have not lost the root, but it's just not shown there. So this is an interesting bifurcation diagram which shows the topology, if you like, of the saddle points as delta tends to infinity. And the same kind of story for the poles, the similar kind of structure. Okay, let me show you now why we're interested in this problem. with reference to the falling film problem, I have here some interesting experiments by Telbay and Portalski back in the long time ago in the 60s. These are for water. What happens actually in the falling film, we have this is an open flow, convectively unstable hydrodynamic system. And the flow goes through a series of spatio-temporal transitions up to the stage where you get two-dimensional solitary pulses. This becomes unstable for water, let's say the Reynolds number is about 40, so this becomes unstable to three-dimensional disturbances, and they give rise to three-dimensional waves which continuously interact in the flow, a bit like quasi-particles, yes? You can see some of these 3D waves here. So, of course, if we wanted to understand this stage of the evolution, by the way, is nothing else but interfacial turbulence, yes? By interfacial turbulence, we mean low-dimensional turbulence, where the surface appears to be complex, but the flow below the interface is actually laminar. So the Reynolds number here is below the usual Tolmin-Schlichting instability, yes, which appears, at least for the falling film, at a Reynolds number of the order of 1,000 to 2,000. So the idea is here to try to understand interfacial turbulence. And of course, the weakly nonlinear prototype that we have been examining is valid for near-critical conditions and so on. And an accurate representation of this phenomenon would require a higher level of approximation than this weakly nonlinear prototype, and I will describe that later on. This is an open question. Nevertheless, we expect that this prototype perhaps captures some of the elements of interfacial turbulence. Notice, for example, that this picture here, prior to this, it occurs somewhere here, yes? You can clearly identify in what appears to be a randomly disturbed surface here, you can identify these nice 3D solitary pulses. Again, with that weakly nonlinear prototype, what we find, if we do time-dependent computations, that is with the GKS equation, we find that the system, at least for sufficiently large delta, evolves into an aggregation, if you like, of 3D solitary pulses. So you could view these pulses as elementary processes, yes, which can be used to describe the dynamics of the system. So then, in a multi-particle approach, we could try to derive equations of motion for these interacting pulses. And this idea is not new. It comes back to particle physics or condensed matter theory, if you like. And it has been used to investigate particle-particle interaction. The complication here is that we have one additional dimension. Okay, so let's try to do a Banner interaction theory. That is, we want to... Let me show you, for example, one sketch here. I'm interested in understanding the interaction of two 3D solitons, shown here from the top, located at x1, z1, and x2, z2. Okay? The solitons are such that each of them is an exact solution. So in an infinite domain, h1 is identical to h2. But because I bring the two solitons together, I want somehow to identify, so I shift them. Okay? And the shifted solitons are represented by these functions here. Okay, so the first one is located at x1, z1, the second one is located at x2, z2, and these locations are actually slow functions of time. So if I bring the two solitons together, remember in infinite domain, each of them is an exact solution, so if you bring them together, it means that they have to overlap, yes, through the exponentially decaying tails. That's why we went through all this exercise to find an approximation for these tails, because they're crucial for the interaction. So this would introduce a correction function here, h hat, yes? A perturbation, if you like, which we have to adjust to represent you have to obtain in order to represent the full profile. So then the idea is to sit, for example, on one of the two solitons. Let's say one, soliton one is the primary one, and I want to examine how two influences one. Okay, so h hat then is effectively a perturbation for the first pulse. By substituting now the expression I had, this expression down here, yes, into my equation, and linearizing for small h hat, I can obtain an evolution equation for this perturbation here. Okay, so this is the term, this is effectively the interaction term here. L is an operator. With a bracket here, we mean that if we operate with L on something, it just goes into this bracket, yeah? There is another term we have neglected here, and that is this term here, is the h to h hat with respect to x. This term is neglected, for example, compared to this one, because notice h hat is the same in both sides, but h2 is much smaller than h1, because 1 is the primary soliton, and I'm looking at what happens, how 2 influences 1. So I'm actually far from 2, where 2 is large. At the same time, this term is smaller, let's say, compared to this term, for example, yeah? Because h hat now is smaller than h1. H hat is just a perturbation. This is a linear equation, yes? So in a sense, what we are saying here is we are looking at a linear interaction. If you like, in condensed matter theory, that would be a long-range interaction, yes? And effectively, we're saying that the interaction can be described by this equation. There is a key here to that theory, the fact that this operator, by neglecting this term, this operator is only influenced by h1, yes? And that is the key here. Because the fact that it's influenced by h1 only means that you can easily identify two null eigenfunctions of this operator. It has a double zero eigenvalue, and these are the two eigenfunctions, the derivatives of h1, the primary soliton with respect to x and z. And these are effectively manifestations of the translational invariance of the system. So what this means is that you could project the dynamics onto this null space, these two eigenfunctions. These are the amplitudes of the projection. Assuming here that the higher order modes decay sufficiently fast, the complement with respect to this space decays sufficiently fast. And this then says that the interaction is effectively due to the translational symmetries. Okay? So each soliton should be stable, but it's only when you bring it to the vicinity of another one, it starts shifting due to the translational invariance. Again, we have an adjoint operator here. And this is something which we have just finished. Of course, to complete the projection, we need to solve the adjoint eigenvalue problem. And we can do the same analytical approximation, as I said before, with the method of steepest descent to obtain the adjoint eigenvalue problem. Why this is so? Because for the interaction, it's only the tails that matter. Okay? For those of you familiar with Shilnikov's theory, the idea is the same, but that is actually in one dimension. It's just the tails that actually are important for the interaction. So we can do this with the steepest descent to obtain the two eigenfunctions, and we have just finished that. But let me show you a complication that would occur here if you wanted to solve it numerically. Because this is a two-dimensional space, you expect two solutions, you expect two adjoint eigenfunctions, but the numerical scheme would give you a mix, a linear combination of the two. psi 1 tilde, psi 2 tilde are superpositions of the original psi 1 and psi 2. So to obtain the original ones, you have to filter out, you have to do projections with the original Langevin functions phi 1 and phi 2, and then you can isolate the original Langevin functions. Okay, so this is another complication that would occur here. Let me show you what they look like. The first eigenfunction, we have not normalized them here, yes? But what you notice is that there are two bulges, a sharp bulge above and another one below the psi equals zero level, and you see some detail here around the primary poles. Effectively, this is a bit like, if you like, an influence function, yes? And the second eigenfunction has more detail around the primary poles. There is more variation here, and now we have two sharp bulges, two above and two below the psi equals zero level. Okay, let me just... What are these amplitudes of the projection? Remember, we have two amplitudes, A1 and A2. If you take a soliton and you translate it slightly, so if this capital X and capital Z are small, you can tailor expand here. So this is the original soliton, so this is nothing else but the perturbation due to translation. It's effectively a shift. So you can rewrite this as the original soliton, the shifted soliton, plus this correction. So this is effectively our correction function. And because the correction function, remember, was projected as A1 times HX plus A2 times HZ, you can identify the amplitudes of the projection with the locations of the soliton. Okay, if we then finalize the projection, that is, we take inner products with the adjoint, we have this 2x2 dynamical system for the location of the second poles, okay, X2, Z2. Remember, the first pulse is stationary. And Psi1 and Psi2 are the two adjoint eigenfunctions. These depend only on H1 because the operator depended on H1 also and hence the adjoint, yes? If you now want to reverse this, if you want to look at the influence the other way around of 1 and 2, we simply replace 2 here with 1, and then instead of having H1, Psi1 and Psi2 are influenced by H2. And we can further define a position vector, okay, whose coordinates are the distances between the two solitons along the X and Z direction. This difference is here. And we obtain that dynamical system by subtracting these four dynamical systems that we had before. Back to this issue of approximating, of looking at the tails only, it turns out that this inner product, a large, attain their maximum value between the solitons. Okay? And that's why we went through all this exercise of trying to obtain an approximate analytical representation, because when these are actually maximum between the solitons, we can just use the tails and obtain analytical expressions for these inner products. And we have done that. It's a lengthy representation, but at least it's somehow in a closed form. Yes, it involves exponentials, cosines, and sines, and so on. What we can do next is obtain the fixed points and the basis of attraction of this dynamical system. So this is the interaction map, which is obtained from the dynamical system. This is Z, okay, and this is X. That's the stationary pulse. That's pulse 1. Okay, and these lines here are the trajectories of the second pulse under the influence of that pulse here. So what we find is that we have a countably infinite number of fixed points. These are subtle points, the alternate and stable nodes. You can see, for example, some of the subtles here. Okay. And these are the stable attractors. So if you put this soliton here, it's going to end up there, let's say, while the soliton here is going to diverge. There are 2 points to note here. First, we only show part of the phase plane simply because that's a linear theory. Yes, so we have to have the two solitons somehow far from each other. And the second, as we move away from the primary poles, is difficult to actually track these fixed points. But this is just to visualize what is happening. From the fully nonlinear system, the full equation, we obtain this interaction map. Again, this is the primary poles. And these open circles here indicate the location of the second poles, the initial location at time zero, let's say. So if you stick a soliton, a second soliton here, it's going to end up at this stable equilibrium state there. If you put it here, it's going to end up there, here, there, and so on. On the other hand, if you put it right behind it, on the z equals zero axis, what you find is that it's going to feel a repulsive interaction from that soliton and it's going to diverge. But this theory, notice, is not so bad. For example, this is a numerics, and it's not so bad compared to the theory. The location of this, let's say, equilibrium state is roughly at minus 11, 12, and this is, let's say, minus 11. And if you go back to the dynamical system approach, if you look at the first stable point, this is also roughly let's say -11, 12, or -11, 12. Yeah. So there is some qualitative agreement. We can see that better, but before we go to this, the important thing of this is that what you obtain now is that at least what the Banner interaction theory shows is that we have the formation of a V-shaped pattern. That is, we have this V-shape here, yes? And the direction of flow is the positive X direction. We'll come back to this in a second. But we can also identify the locations of these equilibrium states by, let's say, the distance from the Z equals zero axis, okay, and half the angle of the V-shape, which we call phi here, the half of the angle of the V-shape. For example, we plot here the first stable point. This is the first equilibrium state closer to the stationary soliton. This is the distance from the x-axis versus delta. The continuous line is the fully time-dependent system, and these stars here are effectively the dynamical system approach. So the theory works, and notice here for the angle phi as a function of delta, the two are not so far from each other. The very interesting thing here is delta tends to infinity, which is the KdV limit, you approach a limiting V-shape angle, so you still have an interaction. And the reason why you have an interaction is because this is never truly the KdV limit, because there you would only have phase interaction. But what happens, as I said before, we still have the instability and dissipation terms. So in the falling film problem, we still have capillarity, surface tension. And so surface tension, which is responsible for the tails, is the force that regulates this interaction, yes? Okay. The time-dependent computation here from the full system. The initial condition at time zero is three coherent structures, which are located somewhere at the back. The two neighboring structures are aligned along the z-axis, and the trailing structure and the third structure is trailing behind, and it has larger amplitude. And after about 150 times units for delta equals 100, we see the formation of this V-shape here. And this is a stationary structure that travels in the downstream direction, yes? The stability of this is another open question also. I'll come back to this. It's not as simple as it seems. Let me see if I can play the movie. So this is the initial condition. We started with a middle structure of larger amplitude located that is trailing. And after some time, the three structures, you see, they realign themselves into this shape. The amplitude of the two neighboring structures increases. This remains roughly the same. And we have this structure, this V-shape. I suppose what is important here is also to notice that the... because you see, delta is not too large. 100 is not so large. So you still see the Kuramoto-Sivashinsky chaos as background noise here. Yes? The conditions, yes. In an extended, this is an extended domain, and we have periodic boundary conditions. There is the question there with the interaction of the periodic extension. That's also an interesting question, because you can lock the system into a structure that appears in time cyclically, but this happens for smaller values of delta. If we make sure the domain is sufficiently large and is enough, if you like, for three structures to be content in that domain, so they don't quite see the periodic extensions, then it's fine. So we have to vary the domain and so on to make sure that it's independent of the domain. For this structure here, we don't use periodic condition because of the depression at the back. So we use a different type of projection in the streamwise direction. Okay, a few thoughts here. Remember I mentioned the idea of the of surface tension and capillarity. So we could view, if you like, these are non-ideal solitons here. So we could view these non-ideal solitons as particles in the van der Waals sense, molecules, yes, in the van der Waals sense, in the sense that we have these dissipation-modified tails. This is a signature of surface tension, once again, at least for the falling film problem. And we know that ideal solitons, when they collide, they behave pretty much like hard spheres, yes? But we also know that liquid gas condensation is not possible if you have molecules with a perfectly repulsive interaction without any attractive part. Okay, so we can view this, if you like, organization here as the analog of a condensation in a gas, not of imperfect molecules, but in a gas of imperfect soliton. So we can call this interfacial turbulence phenomenon as a soliton gas, okay, by analogy with liquid gas condensation. Some of the open questions that we are trying to describe now. As I said before, this is a weakly nonlinear prototype, so it's evident that we need to go to a higher level of approximation. Of course, the highest possible level, that would be full Navier-Stokes, but there is another approximation, so-called the boundary layer equations, which is, if you like, the model equation of choice, which is short, of course, from the full Navier-Stokes. The idea here is that by analogy with boundary layer theory in aerodynamics, we have a projection of the flow field, if you like, into a series of test functions. I don't want to show you the questions because they're very lengthy. But there is a problem with this approximation also, and quite a bit of the effort that we're doing, the effort that we are doing right now has to do with trying to correct this approximation from the point of view of being able to obtain at least details very accurately. Because it turns out that if you don't have an accurate representation of details, you can have, you can modify the location of the fixed points and so on. But let me show you, this is one numerical experiment in which we start here in the domain with a simple 3D solitary pole shown here from above, and these are the capillary ripples. So this is a higher level of approximation than the weakly nonlinear prototype. So we have one pulse, and we excite this pulse. That is, we excite it by giving it some mass. By giving it some mass, we move, we increase its amplitude. Yes. What happens to this mass then? What you see is that the mass drains to the back along the legs. And it drains through, if you like, two shock waves that propagate backwards with a relatively large speed. But as they propagate backwards, these two shock waves, each of them forms another solitary pole shown here. So this shows, if you like, the mechanism of the V-shape formation for something which is now close to the actual fluid dynamics experiment. So we would like to have a theory that actually captures this formation. The complication, which means we need to have eigenmodes, yes, that can actually capture something that, at least to the back of the pulse, looks like a drainage process. So we would like to do the linear stability analysis of this solitary pulse in an infinite domain. And as it turns out, there are two spectra. There is a discrete spectrum, and there is also an essential spectrum. And it's the essential spectrum that is actually responsible for this drainage process to the back. There is a curious object there. I don't want to go into the details about that, but there is a curious object which has to do with crossing, which is an eigenfunction, is a discrete mode that crosses the essential spectrum. So let me just sketch this. This is something which we have done very recently. So I'm looking effectively here in the complex lambda plane, lambda being the eigenvalues of the poles, imaginary part, real part, and it turns out that the locus of the essential spectrum is this. And what we have is discrete modes, let's say here, stable discrete modes, and as we vary one parameter, a bifurcation parameter, some combination of Reynolds and Weber nebulae we have there, delta, these discrete modes cross the essential spectrum, okay? And then they would appear that they disappear. But they don't quite disappear. They are unbounded in one of the directions. In fact, they're unbounded towards minus infinity. They blow up towards minus infinity, but they decay in front of the poles. Well, these are so-called resonance poles, yes, which become true eigenmodes of an appropriately shifted spectrum. So if we shift here the spectrum, these objects, these resonance poles, can become true eigenfunctions. The complication here is that because they are infinite, they blow up towards minus infinity, yes, we have some difficulties with the projection. But this is effectively technical difficulties. But to do that, what we are talking about here is effectively something, another invariance in the system, something that would allow you to actually change the flow rate, something that would allow you to change the substrate, and this is a very subtle invariance. Unlike the translational invariance, this is very subtle, because what we have, we're saying, okay, if you look, for example, back to this equation that I described, we fix the height at infinity, we say, let's say, it's equal to 1 or 0, these are fixed point, and then we vary delta. Imagine now that instead of saying h goes to 1, h goes to some value, which is a substrate thickness, okay? And we vary the substrate thickness for a given delta. And this is another invariance which is very subtle. And this is the invariance here that we'll have to take into account in addition to the translation modes to actually describe, start describing at least what is happening closer to the real fluid dynamics experiment. Yes? And with that, I want to show you just one big picture where a V-shape also happens. It turns out that this is a phenomenon that happens also in nature, yes? This is these are North American geese, can you tell? And they also fly in this kind of formation, but the mechanism, of course, there is different. The front one is usually the stronger one and is trying to minimize drag for the rest of the... through the creation of two vortices here, yes, at the back, for the other ducks. And they actually feel this drag the moment they actually escape a little bit from the V-shape. They have to come back and reorganize themselves. When the front one, when the leading one gets tired, then it gives up, goes to the back, and then another one takes over. Okay, so as I said, there are many open questions, but this is so far what we have done for this problem. Okay, thanks for the attention. The Portalski, yes. Yeah. Ah, there we are, yeah.
You're telling me that you get that pattern there for a little under
40, yeah. This is about 40, yes.
So if I slowly increase the thickness of the field, that slows.
It slowly increases the Reynolds number.
Is this the first thing I see?
Oh, this is the... At the beginning, what you will see is small amplitude monochromatic disturbances.
Just
stretch all the way. Yeah. And then there is a filtering mechanism. Okay, so it selects a particular... so you see, if you like, loss of disturbance. There's this kind of filtering mechanism that selects a maximum growing wave number. Following that, there is an excitation of a superharmonic. There is an interaction with the superharmonic. So this is, if you like, tertiary stage of the instability when the two-dimensional solitary pulses become unstable to the three-dimensional disturbances. So initially you get monochromatic disturbances. Yes. And then you get effectively solitary pulses, and then you get the transverse direction, the transverse instability. So this is the final stage, and what you see here is prior to that. So this is, if you like, the turbulent, if we can call it turbulent behavior, yes.
So there's no experiment you could do where you could just kind of get a fluid going into a uniform and then just start up the little
You can do, this is what, that's something that we are trying to do with a very viscous fluid, so it doesn't go unstable
but
so quickly.
Basically drag a pin down.
Yes, or what you can do is, let's say, with a syringe, that's one idea we had, to deposit like a drop onto the film and see them what they do, yes. But we need a fairly viscous fluid, I guess, something like, I don't know, a silicone oil or so to...
And that would avoid having the effect of your
spontaneous... Yes, fairly quickly, yes. This is actually rapid evolution, yeah. Yes, because... Yes, yes. Well, the actual... We can... this is something that I would like to see in an experiment. This is, as I was saying before, something we're trying to do is with a very viscous fluid to sort of like... Because if you deposit a drop of liquid there, it will relax, okay, because it will start interacting with the flow field, and then it will start assuming the shape of something like a solitary ball. So I would like to see... close to the right after the onset, because the critical Reynolds number for a vertical plane is zero, so it would be easier to do it for an incline. So right after the onset, it would be nice if we can see this kind of shapes. That's a very good point. Yes, I mean.
Really big rotation. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So if the radius tends to is very large, then you approach the planar case. The cylinder is in. I think for the cylinder case, you don't have the transverse, because there are also non-axisymmetric disturbances. These are dampened, I think. So that would probably work. Yeah.
There are actually lots of experiments on what are called rimming flow, which is cylinders with a little bit
on the inside or the outside. Yeah, yeah.
And it produces things sort of like that.
Yeah. But I guess Paul is talking about a vertical, but vertical will also be. A typical slope. These are actually, you see, in that scaling, they appear to be large amplitude structures and they appear to be steep. But if we go to the original, because of the weakly nonlinear expansions, this is a small slope. But to obtain a typical slope, effectively, you mean, near wave breaking, yes. It's the surface tension that prevents it. It's the surface tension that prevents it to break. You could get an estimate of the slope here by balancing gravity, which causes the flow, and the capillary, the streamwise curvature gradient, yes, due to surface tension. So that will give you an estimate of the slope. But the slope is relatively large. So that's why I was saying we need a higher level of approximation also to.
Yeah, people somehow say that the equation for simulation works in the reference.
Lubrication approximation here, yes, strictly speaking, is valid only for sufficiently small Reynolds numbers.
Yes.
This is not lubrication. Yeah, the lubrication actually in this regime, if you increase the Reynolds, the problem with the lubrication is that if you look at like a bifurcation diagram for the speed versus the Reynolds number, you get a turning point. This is the Benny equation, yeah? So you get the speed versus the Reynolds number. Let's say you start with a wave speed, you get typically something like that. So, and this is about order one or so. So if you integrate the lubrication in this region where there are no solitary waves, it actually blows up in finite time. So that's why we need a higher, something which is closer to, a bit like the Skadov approximation. But the Skadov model has problems give you a good representation of the tail. So we have somehow to correct this to obtain something for the tails which is closer to full Navier-Stokes. So in reality this does not turn, but it does something like this in asymptotes. That's for 2D waves. It has symptoms for large R. It's important to have surface tension, as Prof. Fishman said. It's important for the wave breaking. Not for the 3D instability. For the 3D instability, I'm not so sure. It's something we're trying to do now. I'm not so sure really physically what causes the instability in the transverse direction. Because this appears also when you have at the Reynolds number I said about 40 or so, which we are, let's say, somewhere down here, we also have a recirculation zone below this solitary hump in the moving frame. So it could be, it has to do with, let's say, the transport of vorticity in the transverse direction. I'm not so sure. Definitely, as you increase the Reynolds number, surface tension, which is the only stabilizing force, cannot do anything after some state. So you don't have anything else to stop you. So it somehow develops a 3D instability to accommodate the higher speeds. But physically, I wouldn't know why it's doing that. All right. Thank you so much for the attention. Yes.